Hello there and welcome to Marketing Room 101, the podcast where I invite marketers to join me for a good old rant and I give them the chance to banish one thing from the industry forever. I'm your host, Ben Norman, Strategy Director at Principles, the agency that builds unforgettable brands, and you're joining me for possibly my punchiest episode yet. That's because this week I'm joined by Captain of the Underdogs, Paul Meller. If you're not familiar, Paul is the co-founder of Meller & Smith, the ad agency that gets underdog brands noticed. He's the man behind 20 years worth of underdog campaigns, from Paddy Power to Hotels.com to Fat Lad at the Back and many, many more. He was also the exec producer on Boiling Point. He's written a book you can have for free, 13.5 Ways to Grow Your Underdog Brand, and was once described as the type of man that reads the Financial Times and writes ads that go in the sun. Paul's also had ads banned in numerous countries and is the first person to drop the C-bomb in Marketing Room 101. So consider yourself pre-warned. Here is my conversation with Paul Meller. Paul, welcome to Marketing Room 101.
Oh yeah, yeah. Cheers, man. Thanks for having me.
It's quite all right. So, Paul, can you kick us off, please, by just describing the room to our listeners? What's it like in here inside Marketing Room 101?
Well, what has it not got on it? I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? Because marketers are like magpies. They just pick shiny things up and then they bring them into the nest. So it's a complete mess of shiny toys that were, you know, in inverted commas, the hack to move the business forward rather than actually doing any kind of critical thinking or any kind of, well, actually any thinking really. So it's, as a description, it's probably very hot. It's probably in a meeting room because marketers love a meeting room. They don't ever talk to the customer or the public. They'd rather talk about, you know, straw mans or muses or, you know, sort of a version of their customer. And it's got the blockchain, AI, fucking the metaverse. People will be doing search through voice. Apparently that was the thing that was going to be the biggest game changer a few years ago, and that's not materialized. You know, it could not be further from reality, I think, is probably the best way to describe it.
I love it. Are NFTs in here?
NFTs are definitely in here.
NFTs, Google Glass. Augmented Glass. Reality.
Yeah. Yeah. Anything that avoids someone having to think, because they can just go, oh, it's a new tool, the silver bullet that's going to change how we grow the business rather than actually putting the thinking cap on. There's definitely no thinking caps in Room 101.
But I tell you what, I bet there's a hell of a lot of LinkedIn posts coming out of it.
Yeah, there's a lot of LinkedIn bros. Have you noticed that they're almost always men, honestly?
Yeah, with this magic solution to X times your growth.
Ten times your growth. And of course, you know, your MarTech stack. What's your MarTech stack? Anything to do with software, anything to do with, shiny magpie-like blinking lights that are any kind of crutch to the avoidance of doing any kind of thinking.
I would love to invite a customer into this room, like just someone off the street, get Dave in off the street and just ask him. He's on his way to doing his shopping and just invite him in, ask him for his feedback on all this stuff, you know, see if it resonates with him.
Well, of course, that's the thing, isn't it? If you think about, like, let's use the supermarket as an analogy, you know, you're doing your shopping and you've got your 3-year-old child, you know, screaming, lay on the floor, kicking and screaming, and you're sitting in front of the orange juice and you have 3 seconds to decide which orange juice to buy. As a drunk walks past as a pirate, and you go, which one shall I get? The one that has really good social values? Shall I get the one that's only got 3 ingredients? Or shall I just get the one on offer? That's, you know, the person on the street, they do not think about these things anywhere near to the level that marketers think that they do.
No, I absolutely love that. Yeah, which one of these has values that align with mine? As we know, 84% of all people want brands' values to align with their own. And it just means 16% of people are dicks, right? That's what it is. Yeah. It doesn't mean they're prepared to spend more money on them.
Yeah.
So, Paul, you run Meller & Smith, which you've positioned very clearly as the underdog advertising agency. And I want to know, really, what do you think? So we talk about underdogs. I think we all have a bit of an idea in our minds of what we mean when we say an underdog. But thinking about brands, what do you think is the difference between an underdog, a big dog, and a lame dog?
It's very clear. So in pretty much every category, in every industry, in every country, in every world, in this world, there are some dynamics within that category. The top 2 or 3 brands are the biggest brands in that category. They are the richest, most profitable. They're the ones with all of the weight, all of the power, all of the potency. So they're the ones that can employ these big brand playbooks. That'd be, you know, top 2 or 3 brands in that category. And then you have our definition of an underdog is a brand between 4th and 10th place. Now, we have some other elements that go into that definition as well, but ultimately they are between 4th and 10th place. And anyone below 10th, they're just too small. It's not fair. sucks. They're just too small. They don't have the retail footprint. They don't have the what Byron Sharp would call physical availability. They don't have the potency. Yeah. They don't have the mass. There's just not enough of it for it to have any real impact. And so then what we work with is our clients are between fourth and 10th place. And really, we're looking for the one brand in that fourth to 10th place of those underdogs. There is one in every category that really fancies it. There's not two. There's not three. There's one who really, really fancies it. They probably have somewhere between 50 and 500 staff. You go beyond 500 people and stuff just gets stuck in the mud. They've probably got a marketer with some big brand experience. That person has probably been at a big brand who understands what it's like to be at the top of that category. And they have the wherewithal, like I say, the fight. They've got something about them where every single decision is about breaking into that top two or three. Because anyone who says it's easy has never done it. It is incredibly difficult. The biggest brands squash little brands. All of the advantages are in their favor. Yeah. All they have to do is just maintain the status quo. And the job of the underdog is to break into those top two or three. And there is only one thing they can do. They got to do the one thing that the biggest brand can't, won't, or daren't do. That is it. It's really, really simple, but also really difficult and really exposing because, you know, doing the one thing that the biggest brand can't, won't, or daren't do, you know, you're putting your neck on the block there. But that's ultimately the thing that will move an underdog from between fourth and 10th place to first, second, or third place.
Essentially, you're double fucked, aren't you, if you're a small brand? Because you, and I don't even know if it's just double, there's so much against you. The bigger brands have got more to spend. The bigger brands, when they do spend, it makes more effect because we know that if you've already got awareness, it's much easier to advertise and much easier to grow. There's just so much piling up against you, isn't there? And I think from my experience working with smaller businesses, it's that idea that we can just incrementally grow by investing in advertising. And it's like, you can't forget that your competitors have far bigger budgets than you do. They are spending more than you are. You are pushing water uphill unless you're doing something different, distinctive, interesting, entertaining, right?
Yeah, 100%. Let's just be clear. An underdog can be they can be pretty meaty businesses. So an example of an underdog for us, we've been working with Brooks Running Shoes for the last sort of 18 months, 2 years. Mm. That's a $1 billion business. Warren Buffett owns them, but they're an underdog. They're in what? Fifth place in Europe in the running shoe category with, you know, Nike and Adidas at the top. And then you'll have Asics. And then you've got a bunch of them, you know, Brooks, Saucony, Hoka, On Running. So they're in that little sort of chasing pack between sort of fourth and seventh, right? But they're still a $1 billion business, but they're an underdog, like 100%.
Yeah.
They are fighting, trying to gain market share from their competitors. The idea that an underdog just wants to, they increase their spend in order to compete and then nobody else is actually doing the same is ludicrous. Yes, you can grow market share through excessive share of voice, but the amount of cash you have to flood your category with in order to gain market share through excessive share of voice, wowzers. It's like, you know, sledgehammer and, you know, and a nut, really. The far more effective thing is to outthink the competition, do the thing that the competition can't, won't, or daren't. And it's pointless doing the thing that another underdog can't, won't, or daren't. You got to do the thing that the biggest brand can't, won't, or daren't. Because if we think about double jeopardy, where does your growth come from? You got to take the customers from the first, second, or third brand, because there's fucking millions more of them. There's so many more of them. So you have to take those customers. We have to accept that there's absolutely no loyalty. Even the biggest brands have relatively low penetration and low levels of loyalty. They just have slightly more penetration and slightly more loyalty than the fifth or sixth biggest brand.
Yeah, but if you're working with Brooks and you're trying to steal a sale from Salomon running shoes or whatever it might be, it's an underdog scrap, isn't it, with each other? Yeah. Whereas you don't need to convince that person away from Nike necessarily wholesale, do you? You just have to try and pull one sale down from Nike every three. Because like you said, 70% of the sales are going to Nike and Adidas.
The research that sort of bears that out is from Jenny Remenenchu's book, Building Distinctive Brand Assets. And the research showed in the UK that 72% of people consider one brand when they're at the consideration phase, right? A further 18% of people consider two brands. So therefore, if you put those two together, 90% of people consider two brands. So if you want to grow, you're an underdog, only a crazy person would focus any attention on the 10% of people that are clearly the whack jobs who consider more than three brands when they're considering a purchase. You should put all of your efforts in making sure you're one of the two brands that 90% of people consider when they're about to make a purchase in that category.
I think I've had quite a lot of fun researching for this chat, because as I've been listening and reading, it's been almost like a form of therapy for me, where somebody gives you affirmation that all your rants and frustrations, all these things that are always going around in my mind, they're actually valid and shared by someone else. So I kind of want to thank you for that, really. But I think the biggest issue in our industry isn't that a lot of advertising is bad. It's that most advertising isn't even interesting enough to be bad. It's kind of this utterly ignorable landfill. And I love the point that you made on Louis Grenier's podcast previously, where you make the point that if 89% of bridges fell down, then architects would be fired. I think that's the analogy that you use. And it's like, if 89% of advertising is wasted because it isn't remembered and advertisers are somehow getting away with it, I can't get my head around why that's still the status quo. Why do you think it is? Why do you think we're able to produce utterly forgettable advertising and we continue to get away with it?
Okay, I mean, that's probably a podcast series in itself. But I think there are a number of things that feed into it. It is a huge subject. That's the first thing to say. And it isn't one thing. None of us are idiots here. You know what I mean? Like, it's not as if the marketing industry is just full of idiots. There we go. Well, this is the answer. So to answer your question, like, why is it so ineffective? There's a whole bunch of reasons. I think one of the biggest reasons is there's a really low barrier to entry when it comes to the marketing department. You know, you don't get into the accounting department of a business, you know, or the finance department without having studied maths or accountancy or some sort of level of training that brings you in at the junior level of that department and then you work your way up. And there's a real adversity to formal training. Now, I think that's started to change, certainly in Europe, with Mark Ritson's mini MBA and a number of others. Proper formal marketing training has really galvanized over the last few years. So that has started to change, but that's a really big problem. Another sort of really big influence around that is it's flipping difficult. You know, I mean, like making effective advertising is incredibly difficult. I mean, it sounds really big-headed, but I think we're world-class at making effective advertising for underdogs. But it ain't easy. I've been doing this 20 years and you still occasionally knock out a dud. Like, it's not as if every single thing we ever do is an absolute home run. It's incredibly difficult. The other thing, of course, is that effective advertising is essentially a nudge. Advertising is a soft power. If it was a really big, hard power, like pull on this lever and the gold will start flowing into your business, whoa, everyone would be straight on that, wouldn't they? It's a really soft power. It nudges someone over a period of time. A number of nudges make that person more likely to buy. And then I think the other thing about marketing is that marketing touches every single part of an organization far more than any other department. Possibly only the finance department touches as many different departments within an organization. And that by being really broad, I think that dilutes marketing's impact in a lot of organizations. And therefore, that knock-on effect that the output of marketing becomes ineffective.
I think that touches on the, we talked earlier a little bit about tactics versus strategy, or right at the start when you were describing the room, and we talk about the idea of just loads of people grabbing at handles, grabbing at tactics, rather than actually thinking about what to do first. But strategy is the art of choosing what not to do rather than what we should do. Or it should at least be as focused on what you cut rather than what you include. I think it speaks to that, doesn't it?
Yeah, I have to say, I mean, I've been doing this a long time now, 20 years. The best clients, the best marketing departments are the ones that are absolutely laser focused. The most effective work is done when the marketing department knows exactly what it is they're trying to do over the next 12 months, over the next 24, 36 months. They have already made the strategic decisions about how they're going to support the commercial objective of the business. Then how does that filter through into the marketing objective of the business? There should be one, possibly two at the absolute most. What is it we are trying to do in order to make the business hit its commercial objective? Then that cascades down into everything.
Couldn't agree with you more. That focus, that's the word that it always comes back to, isn't it? So before we get into you banishing something,
I understand you're a fellow loiterer, and I understand you and I have both, well, I know I certainly have, I presume you have, been asked to leave certain places because you believe in this crazy idea of actually watching real people as they're shopping or speaking to people in the real world, which seems to be this novel idea. But I want to know, if you were to make your case now to marketers, what's the benefit in actually speaking to real people who many would argue it's not representative? You can't scale that out to some form of mass data that proves that they're representative of everybody else. It's hard to do. It takes a load of time. You have to have the balls to go and have that conversation or the balls to be prepared to get kicked out of a supermarket. So why is it worth doing that?
Well, the first thing to say is, yeah, I've lost count. Mm. Amount of times I've been kicked out of shops, various establishments over the years. But so what is the case? The case is very simple. If you have the appetite to create impact, then you need to go and speak to real people. It's really simple. But if you are somebody that wants to do that, there is nothing more effective than just going speaking to some people. Now, we've used Brooks, kind of mentioned them as an example of a client of ours. Our first project with them, we went and spoke to 100 runners just up and down the country. Like, not huge, just going and chatting to them. Now, was it representative? No, it wasn't. But like, was it 100 real runners of all different shapes and sizes up and down the country doing different types of disciplines, different types of running? Yeah. All right. Well, what did we learn? Absolutely fucking loads. It couldn't be more fruitful. It's almost like the compost that your ideas grow out of. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
Yes, doing really big market research studies. They are expensive. They can take time. I'm not saying you shouldn't do those things, but shall we just go and speak to some real people? Because it will give us some compost from which ideas might grow. Mm. You've got something that your competition don't have, because the vast majority of brands don't do that. So you're already putting yourself at an advantage.
So the time has come, Paul, for you to banish something from the marketing world. So what would you like to banish, please?
I would like to banish underdogs acting like big brands. You fall over the number of big brand marketers at Cannes telling you about how flipping clever they are and how brilliant their playbook is at being able to impact their category and sort of grow their business. And then you've got like 1,000 other people in the crowd going, oh, fuck me, let me write that down. This 5-point like plan, fail-proof plan about how to follow this supposed playbook. Underdogs who use the playbook from big brands, it's just a complete non-starter. And just for extra frustration, they do it while casually ignoring the one massive and glaring problem that the playbook for the biggest two or three brands in every category works for them for one reason and one reason only. They're already massive. Would you ignore that one huge, glaring and obvious thing that is in their favor? The biggest lever that any big brand has is they're just massive, right? So why would you casually ignore that? The only way for underdogs to change the status quo is to do the one thing that the biggest brand can't, won't, or daren't do. There is your playbook. Really simple. And that's really scary. It's really exposing. We've already talked about the essence of strategy is sacrifice. It's working out what you're not going to do before you're going to work out what you are going to do. So underdogs, instead of sort of doing the one thing that the biggest brand can't, won't, or daren't do, they corral around the central theme of a category with a head in the sand, ignoring, like I say, the massive fucking glaring problem with copying the playbook of any big brand, which is you need to be massive for it to work.
There are so many things where when you say them out loud, like what you're saying out loud there, but it sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? But it seems to be the status quo. This idea of, right, what we want to do is we want to grow in our category. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at what the market leader's doing, because they must have done a good job. So if we do what they've done, rather than looking at, like you say, they've got more money to spend than you have, and people are already massively aware of them. Therefore, their marketing job, their advertising job is really bloody easy.
Yeah.
You know, that's played out in that chart that we've all seen, which says the biggest amplifier of creative effectiveness is being massive.
Yeah, that's the Kantar research, isn't it, with Paul Dyson, which is if you look at the levers, the top 10 levers that a brand has to pull in terms of like how to make themselves more effective from a communication point of view, by far, by absolutely miles, the biggest lever to pull is just being massive. Like only the top two or three can pull that one.
Right.
So immediately you have to ignore that one. But of course, every brand brand doesn't. They go, we'll just pull that big lever. We'll just pull that one, yeah. The one that doesn't exist to them. The second most effective lever that they can pull is creative effectiveness, the ability to be creatively distinct. That completely swamps all of the others. That is the biggest lever that an underdog can pull, because that lever does exist to an underdog. But you don't have to be massive to pull that one. But of course, everyone casually ignores that one.
I think something that's maybe not spoken about so much as well is the level that you have to be at for creative to be effective. And by that, I mean, if we talk about humor, we talk about entertainment. We're not saying, does this tick the box in our minds of being deemed an entertaining idea? What we're saying is it has to be as good as the other content that it sits between if it's in a social feed. It has to be as good as the other programming that is on their TV. Like, is that genuinely going to make somebody talk about on the bus, share with their mates in a WhatsApp group, talk about at the school gates, talk about at work? It's not enough to just tick a box and say, yes, we are making an entertaining ad. Put that through the scrutiny of the likes of Netflix. You know, you can't just say it's entertaining, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I got involved in Boiling Point. So I was the exec producer on Boiling Point, and I've always wanted to, I mean, because I'm a bit of a knobhead, I've always wanted to make, you know, the TV shows in between the ads that we make on the telly. So we make plenty of TV ads. And I was like, well, I want to make like stuff in between. And it was like, you know, put your money where your mouth is. What kind of TV series do you want to get involved in? And so I got involved in, the first one was with Boiling Point. So I was an exec producer on the film that has to go out, you know, goes out in the cinema, goes all over the world. Brilliant. And then it runs on Netflix and Apple TV, and it has to compete with people's attention. And then so much so, it's then been sold and turned into a four-part series on the BBC. You know, like, you're thinking, how do we compete making TV ads? Well, you've got to make something that stands out in the TV break on a Saturday night, you know, when it's Ant and Dex takeaway, whatever it's called. Like, yeah, you really got to work hard. And that's exactly the same if you're making a social feed ad or a TV ad or making an ad before the feature film goes on in the cinema, whatever it might be. You have to get someone's attention. If you're ignored, everything else is academic. Like, my admiration for our clients, where they've had to put their, you know, their neck on the block a bit. They've stuck themselves out there, and it is scary and it is exposing. Like, I've got so much empathy for that decision that a client makes, but that's what it takes. And as a client, you need an agency that holds your hand through that process, is with you. They're on the same side as you. You know, the amount of times that we've made ads that have been banned, you know, we've made them to be banned. The client's like, right, you have to weigh up the reputational risks with the commercial gains and understanding whether that's the right thing for them to do or not. You know, we wrote Fat Cunt and 1,000 billboards. You know what I mean? Like, that is an aggressive thing to do for a sports brand. But, you know, it got them noticed big time. Like, the effect that had, putting that brand, Fat Lad at the back, a fellow Yorkshire brand, putting them front and center of the conversation for fat people who like cycling. You know, that's not for everyone. Like I say, it's like this quite mavericky, not playing by the rules of everybody else. But they want a partner that is in the trenches with them. And that's ultimately what we try and do.
I think that's where the conversation about risk becomes interesting. Because I remember Fat Lad at the Back coming around, if I remember rightly, when the Tour de France was hosted in Yorkshire. And I do remember it being very, it was brave. It was maverick, like you say. And when it came about, you're thinking, actually, yeah, there's a real provocation here. But something interesting when we think about the question of risk there. So you're starting a brand from scratch that no one's ever heard of before. If you don't get noticed, so let's say they didn't have as much money to spend as the massive brands that would have been spending at that time. Let's say it's the Raffers, etc. of the world, then what is the risk of having that provocative maverick approach? The risk is it backfires, but the status quo is you have a small brand and you're not going to be noticed. The conversation of risk almost needs reframing, doesn't it?
Well, the cost of being dull. You know, that's the research that was done back end of last year with System One and Peter Field. You know, the cost of being dull in the UK is put at about £15 billion a year. That's how much advertising is just poured down the toilet. And if you're the biggest brand, then you can afford to do that. If you're not the biggest brand, then you can't, you know, like Fat Lad at the Back in that example. When we started working with them, they were the 10th biggest in terms of market share of the cycling jersey category. Yeah. So they couldn't afford to just pour a load of money down the drain. Rafa could. I mean, I'm not saying Rafa were, but the pockets were deep enough for them to be able to do that. Now, at that point, what are fat lads' options? Like you say, they can kind of do something on the edges where they're able to, like, one-on-one influence people with very little kind of mass, broad reach. Or they can try and get the attention of as many people as possible within the segment that they have highlighted that is really valuable to them. And that's the choice they have to make. Then you go, right, are they the only brand trying to talk to that segment? No. If they were, bonza. It's the easiest job in the world if you've highlighted a segment that nobody else has, but that doesn't exist. So somebody else is also trying to attract the attention of that segment. So how do you get the attention of that segment? You have to do the thing that the other brands can't, won't, or don't. Very, very simple, really difficult to do, really exposing, really scary. But if you want to just, like, piss some money down the drain, then don't do the thing that other people can't, won't, or don't. And that's your risk.
I suppose this comes down to that point, doesn't it? Do you want to resonate heavily with a few people or not at all with a lot of people? I can hear the conversation now where if the client isn't a maverick, they're saying, are you trying to suggest for a second that we call our customers fat? And you're like, actually, on the surface, yeah, possibly quite a risky, quite a bold, quite a maverick move. But it works. And if you let the fear of offending overwhelm the sort of pursuit of really resonating with that audience, then it wouldn't have been half as successful as it was, would it?
Yeah. You know, this is where I've got a lot of empathy with clients. Like, you know, the marketing director of a client, their neck is on the line. You know, they've got kids in private school. They've got mortgages to pay. They've got lives to lead that suddenly become a lot more difficult if they lose their job. You know, I get it. Like, it's a very difficult job for a chief marketing officer or a VP of marketing to be able to put effective advertising out there, because in order to be effective, you have to do the thing that other people aren't doing. So that's inherently puts people in a sort of an area where they feel exposed. But like I say, the best people, best marketers, they know instinctively that that's what they've got to do. For me, that's what I talk about. Like, within that fourth to 10th place, there is only one brand. I've been in this a long time. It's very rare that I've spoken to a category where I've spoken to four or five of the VPs of marketing in a category and all of them fancy it. No, one of them fancies it. And we're pretty good at being able to, you know, sort of sniff out who that person is.
So you mentioned that the way towards becoming the underdog and to grow as an underdog is to find the one thing that the market leader or the market leaders can't do. You need to find that one thing and then do it. If you could speak directly to a brand owner right now and they're looking at getting started in this direction, what's the sort of first step that they would take in trying to find that thing beyond obviously just giving you a ring?
Yeah, the one thing they do is give me a bell. The second thing they could do, maybe they don't want to talk to me. Maybe they think I'm a bit of a knobhead, so that's fine. The second thing they could do would be to download the book that we've written, which is 13 and a half ways to grow your underdog. That's sort of like next level of, you know, there'll be 13 things in there. Well, it's 13 and a half. Each of them are different ways of looking at it. They all kind of take you to the same place. The other thing is this stuff is really, really difficult. Like, if it was easy, everyone would have a big brand, right? So probably the biggest thing you can do as a brand owner to improve your chances is to get somebody on your team who has done this before. Yep. So that's why when we talk about underdogs, when we talk about the definition of our underdogs, we always include within the definition that they have to have a senior marketer who has been a senior marketer at a big brand before. So they understand what it's like to be the category leader, because then they'll know what it feels like, what you have to do in order to maintain the status quo, because that would have been their job. And the biggest thing you can do as a brand is to do that, is to get somebody on your side, as it were, who has done it before. That will cost you money. Now, one really, really valuable, potent, powerful person is worth hundreds of doers. Now, there are different ways of doing that. First way, obviously the way that I think is the best way, is hire somebody like me. You don't have to take the headcount, but really, that's not for everyone. You know, get somebody in your business that has done it before. That is the quickest and shortest way to being able to start making these moves. And now that sounds really, really basic. It's like, oh, you're just saying hire a smart person, but that's ultimately what it is. Somebody that thinks for a living. That's ultimately what it needs. What do they need to be thinking about? Well, we need to start thinking about and mapping the central themes of that category from a communication point of view, product point of view, sort of brand point of view. Where are
the different people within that category operating from a product point of view? Where are they operating from a communication, and where are they operating from a brand? And then you will start to map out ultimately where your white space is. And where your white space is will be something that the other people within your category can't, won't, or daren't. Now, there's 1,000 steps within that. That's ultimately what you're trying to find.
I'm a big fan of an analogy, but I think in this instance, it's like, if you keep missing the target, do you go and buy more ammo? And is the solution, let's just have loads more ammo? Or do you find someone who knows where to point the gun?
Yeah.
Like, it feels like what he's saying is, let's not throw more money at this. It's not about, if you have more media investment, then great. But really, what you need is to know what's the map, what's the route we're going to take, how we're going to get there, and exactly what the destination is, and be very, very single-minded and planning it in that way, rather than just throw more ammo in the gun, fuel on the fire, whatever we want to, whatever analogy you want to use.
Yeah, you got to sail with the shipwrecked. Right. The smartest sailor sails with somebody who has been shipwrecked, because he knows where all the dangerous reefs are. He knows, he or she, this is a quote from the geezer that wrote Robinson Crusoe. I can't remember his name off the top of my head. Yeah, sail with the shipwrecked, because only he knows where the most dangerous reefs are.
Love that. I think that's brilliant. So I think that's a good point for us to lock that in. So we're going to lock in underdogs acting like big brands in Marketing Room 101. How does that make you feel? Do you feel good about that?
I feel redemptive. You know, yeah. I feel like I should go to the pub and have a pint.
Perfect. So that's what we hope to achieve with this. Some form of cleansing, I think.
It's like a church.
Yeah, but without it, well, I won't go there. While you're here, Paul, would you like to bring anything back into the marketing world to take with you before you go?
Yeah, the biggest thing is, again, and it sounds really, really basic, and this is the kind of stuff that, you know, kind of brings it back to the start of our conversation. The things that are really effective are the things that aren't sexy, and they are not fashionable, but they're really effective. You know, the things that are ineffective are sexy and shiny, certainly in the world of marketing at the moment, and have been over the last 20, 30 years. Like, what would I like to bring back? Critical thinking. Like, the practice of fucking thinking. Like, not shooting their mouths off like keyboard warriors, because people just don't think anymore. They think they're thinking, but they're not. They're just managing an inbox, and they're fighting Colin for the corner office. What's the quote? Is a novelist that I can't remember their name. People think with their fingers these days. You know, all people do is think with their fingers, because speed is everything. Like, being able to manage corporate politics or whatever it might be has to be done quickly, and has to be done through email or messaging or whatever it is. And there's very little value put on just thinking. Some of the most effective things that I've seen with clients, we have clients that are with us for a long time, and over a period of years, you know, you sort of see the ebbs and flows of how their career is developing and the different ways that they're operating. Some of the most effective things that people have done has been, for example, locking out the first 2 hours of the day every day. Some clients will go, right, between 9 and 11, you can't contact me. Nobody can contact me. That's my thinking time, for example. Or not having meetings over lunch. It's such basic, like, I mean, that doesn't happen in France. I mean, I live in France. Nobody puts a meeting between 12 and 2. If you do, there ain't nobody going to turn up. You know what I mean? So, like, this really, really basic stuff, like the ability to think. Now, anyone can think, but to be able to think critically, like really deep critical thought, the things that, like, really can be able to untangle really thorny issues, be able to outthink the competition, that doesn't happen at the click of a finger where you're like, oh, there's the answer. Now, it may well be that you have an answer off the top of your head, but it may not be the answer. So what does the modern marketing world need? It needs more critical thinking. Sounds really boring, really old-fashioned, not sexy at all, yet it's really, really valuable and incredibly powerful.
There's something really interesting in this point of, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. As a person whose job is to do that, I'd like to hope that I spend a lot of time not just thinking with my fingers. But I think it's interesting because in a recent episode, Mick Mahoney, one of the things he wanted to banish was problem spotters, brackets, critical thinking. He said nothing good ever came from critical thinking. But I think you're both right. And I think you're both right because I think it's choosing when to be hard on the problem and choosing when to give people freedom to think creatively, isn't it? And I think critical thinking when it comes to the briefing process, when it comes to what are we actually positioning this business around? What's that one thing? That takes a lot of critical thinking. But I also think there are, I get where he's coming from, where he's kind of like, also, don't crush the magic from a great idea by trying to pick holes in it. It's a bit of a nuance.
Define those two different things. So my critical, we'll go mine first because I'm the most important.
Yeah.
My critical thinking is exactly strategic thought. It is being critical and self-critical about the thinking that you're doing and pushing forwards, always like looking to improve, looking to build on something, looking to innovate, looking to join two things together that have never been joined before, looking to do the thing that nobody else is doing, looking to outthink the competition. That is critical thinking. I think what your man that you're referring to, now I happen to agree with them when they're talking about critical thinking, is people that play devil's advocate, people that pick holes in things or crush ideas, lest we forget that ideas in their infancy are incredibly fragile. They're so fragile they can be killed in a couple of sentences. And someone that says, I just want to play devil's advocate, no, you can fuck off. That's just an idiot maintaining some sort of corporate politics, like sort of visage. They should not be nowhere near the room of a decent idea. That doesn't mean that I don't like criticism or critique or people looking to find the holes in an idea, just like, I'm going to play devil's advocate. Like, mate, we can all do that. That takes literally zero skill. Like, Gavin, the fucking T-boy, can do that. If that's your game, then go be the fucking T-boy. Yeah. Like, challenging ideas, stress testing them. That's critical thinking.
No, I love that, and I will let you have that back. So you can take critical thinking, and you can distribute that to the whole industry.
I'm going to be like one of those, like, is it a Nerf gun? Like, that's what my kids have. I'm going to load it up, and I'm going to fire it out there so people can grab it and catch it.
And then any paper-thin creative ideas that are tactic-led, they're all just going to dissolve on impact as someone starts challenging them. So before you go, I have one last question. So in every episode, I ask a brother's question. My brother doesn't work in the industry, but he sends me a question every week for my guest. And this week, he wanted to ask you, Paul, outside of the commercial world, what's your favourite underdog story? Fact or fiction? The one that makes you think, fuck yeah, whenever you think about it.
You know, I am a sucker for against the odds. Like, I'm a massive sucker for that. I have to say, I loved and still love the story of Eric the Eel, who is a swimmer in the, I think it was the Athens Olympic Games, so 2004. Right. And I can't remember his surname. His first name was Eric, but he became Eric the Eel was his kind of his nickname. And he was in the heats of the 100 meters freestyle. And in the heats, it just so happened there was only other two or three of them in their heat. And the other two false started. So he had a pass to be able to get through to the next round, but he had to actually compete. Like, he couldn't just go, yeah, well, I'm the only one here, so I go through to the next round. But of course, he couldn't really swim that well. He was from Eritrea. And so he'd learned to swim in the sea. And I don't think he'd ever swum 100 meters before. And so he had to swim his first 100 meters in front of the world's media in an Olympic-sized swimming pool on his own. And he dived in and he absolutely creamed the first 50. Like, ooh, this guy is going. And then the second 50 gets slower and slower and he's really struggling. Oh, no. But he finally makes it to the end and he touches the end. He's clearly exhausted, much to the raptures of the crowd. And he became Eric the Eel.
I love that. I almost confuse it in my mind with Eddie the Eagle. These little unlikely Olympic stories are brilliant, aren't they? I'll give that a look.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you've got to have a heart of stone not to root for the underdog, not to root for the person where the odds are stacked against them. You know, you really have to be a sort of, you know, a cold, heartless Iceman. You know, most people are rooting for the underdog. They want the underdog. They want the surprise of the victory.
That's where there can be real power in this, can't they? There's real power in that idea of being a real challenger, a real underdog to the big cold corporate. And I suppose that leads me on nicely to where can people find out more about your work and see the great work that you've done, Paul?
So yeah, 13 and a half ways to grow your underdog. It's a book that we wrote. It's now in its fourth edition. It's absolutely chock-a-block full of different ways that underdogs can look at the problem they have and going to essentially find a bit of a path forwards. But they can find it on our website, which is mellerandsmith.com. There is also a sports specific one as well, because we do sort of specialize in sports brands. But yeah, that's the best thing that somebody could do. And if they want to, I put up videos on LinkedIn, and so if they follow me on LinkedIn, they can have a little daily dose of me giving you sort of one tip a day on what an underdog can do to kind of change the game in their favor.
Paul, thank you very much for coming in. It's been a pleasure.
Cheers, man. Thanks very much.
So that was my conversation in Marketing Room 101 with Paul Meller. Thank you very much for listening. If you enjoyed it as much as I did, I'd love it if you could please send a link to just one person who you think will enjoy it too. And remember, if you've done anything recently that you feel guilty about, perhaps you've been using someone else's Pizza Express dressing in the office fridge, you can cancel out the bad karma in just 30 seconds by leaving a review of Marketing Room 101 wherever you get your podcasts. Finally, if you'd like to get in touch with me, or if you'd like to arrange a free chat about how I and the Principals team can grow your brand, just find me on LinkedIn under my name, Ben Norman. I'm the one with no hair. And if you'd like to know more about Principals, just head to principalsagency.co.uk.